Hey, let's open our Bibles. We'll be in Judges this evening, chapter 13 to 16, the longest of the Judges stories, and perhaps the most famous, Samson. Samson is among the most misunderstood of all of the Bible characters. Usually when you say that, what you mean is the person isn't as bad as we thought they were. Isn't that the way you normally mean it? if you hear two people talking about a third person and one person says, well, I think they're really misunderstood. Usually what you assume is that people think worse of them than they really are. That's not the case with Samson. I hate to tell you, but if Samson's your hero, you're not going to like tonight's Bible study very much. If Samson's your hero, you probably don't know all that much about him. It might be just as well. He's the hero of kids because he's strong. Or at least he has a dynamic. He's able to do physical feats. Anyway, there's nothing in there that says his muscles were really big. It wasn't about his muscles anyway. He might have just been really wimpy looking. We don't know. Wimpy looking guy with long hair, you know, who knows? But the strength came from God. So there's no indicator that he looked like a bodybuilder, though we usually picture him that way. There's a sense in our culture when, where I think it's mostly among kids, where they respect physical strength over moral strength and over character. And almost everything in our culture tends to promote that. Image is everything, and I think that's how Samson sort of becomes a hero. In real life, the hero in the Samson story is God, as with all the judges. The judges remind us that the Lord can use anybody, and that the Lord has determined to bless his people, that he will accomplish his work, and if necessary, he'll use even unworthy subjects to accomplish great things so that overall God's plans are accomplished. Samson's account, even though he is among, and even Jephthah is in the list of people who trusted God for things in Hebrews 11. There's no details about him in Hebrews 11, just said he was one of the many who trusted God for things. Even though he's in that list, what we find out about him in this account, and I will be doing a run-through of this account. This could actually be four messages. What we find out about him in this account is that he was pretty normal as far as being a human being, and in a lot of ways, kind of subnormal. In a lot of ways, just didn't have a grip at all on what it meant to really be a man of God. As we walk through this, we'll see some more about it. But the story begins during the dark ages of Israel, as I've mentioned before. The story begins with Israel having turned away from God yet again in this recurring cycle. And what you've noticed if you've studied through the book of Judges is that with each recurring cycle, they get more and more like the Canaanites. And what we'll find as we get into this story of the Philistines and Samson is that Israel is so much accustomed to having the Philistines rule over them that they actually get upset with Samson at one point because he makes war against the Philistines. They don't want to rock the boat. And what we find in Samson is a strong similarity in terms of the way he deals with the Philistines, in terms of his moral actions toward the Philistines, a strong similarity between him and the Canaanite world. And what we found through the book of Judges is that in this recurring cycle of obedience, obedience and then success and then rest and then carnality and then acting like the Canaanites again and then having God judge them and then crying out to God and coming back to God, in this recurring cycle, they seem to be getting worse. So by the time we get to the Samson story, you will notice in it that there is no crying out. In all the rest of them, it's like, oh, Israel cried out to God and said, we're so sorry. Would you please send us a deliverer? That doesn't happen in the Samson story. God initiates it. God initiates it without asking anybody. Nobody's there to intercede. Nobody's there to cry out. Nobody cares. Now, that's worse than being in a situation where at least you care and you're in a bad situation. It's worse to be in that and not care. And that's the way it is. You'll also notice as you go through this that it does not end by saying, and there was peace in Israel. It says that Samson judged Israel for 20 years, but it does not indicate a complete victory. In fact, you'll notice that even as he's called, when the angel says that this is going to happen, it says he'll only begin to deliver Israel from the Philistines. He doesn't finish it. He never finishes the job. And apparently what happens is not a complete victory over the Philistines at all. In fact, there is no complete victory over the Philistines until generations later. What happens is simply this sort of delaying technique that occurs, and largely because Samson, if you'll notice, never actually leads a battle. He never rallies the people. He never says, we need to stand up and walk with God. He never says, let's fight the Philistines like God told us to in the first place. Never does any of that stuff. He kills a bunch of Philistines. But we'll see why and how that works out. Notice also as we begin it that the Lord is determined to judge the Philistines. One of the main things that happens here is not just that Samson becomes a hero. One of the main things that happens is that God is determined to thrash the Philistines. And the Philistines were interesting people. They were from Crete, Kaftor, they used to call it, which is an island in the middle of the Mediterranean. And they had been living for hundreds and hundreds of years on the coastlands here. In fact, let me show you where they lived, and I'll show you at the same point where all this takes place. Find your maps in the back. The Philistines were quite up-tempo. We tend to think of them as being very rude and gross-looking and kind of like the Klingons of the world. I always had a picture of the Philistines that way. But that's not the case. Find a map in the back that says something about Canaan divided among the 12 tribes or something like that. That'll be the right map. And you'll notice if you can find the Dead Sea and then move from the Dead Sea over towards the Mediterranean, when you get to the coastland there, you'll find five cities. This was the kingdom of the Philistines. They are, if you can identify them, Ekron. See if you can find Ekron. It's in the tribe of Dan. And right below it, there's a valley, the Valley of Sorek. And we'll see how that plays into this in a minute. Ekron, and then south of that, still inland a little bit, is Gath. It's where Goliath was from. He was a Philistine. Then you go to the coast and you see three cities along the coastline, Ashdod, Ashkelon, and Gaza. It's where Gaza Strip gets its name. Gaza's still there. This is all Palestinian territory today. Incidentally, the name Palestine, all comes from the word Philistine. That's where the term came from. It's Philistine. That's where Palestine got its name. The Romans picked it up from the Philistines, and they just named it that. They named the territory Palestine. That was the Roman name for it. Israel called it Israel. God called it Canaan. The Philistines were Philistines, and the Romans named it after them. And that's how it got the name Palestine. What happens is, you see the town just below Ekron, a little bit inland, called Timnah, Zorah, Beth Shemesh, House of the Sun. There was some sun worship, by the way, Shemesh, sun worship going on. A lot of paganism that had infiltrated Israel. This is the area right in there. You see the Valley of Sorek and all around these little towns. This is where Samson's story takes place. Now, let's go back and I'll tell you about the Philistines. Philistines were rather up-tempo. They had all the weaponry. They had state-of-the-art technology, metallurgy, much better than Israel did. The Israelis had to come to the Philistines in order to get their tools sharpened. The Philistines had the ability to do the metalwork. They also had chariots and horses, which the Israelis did not have. They also had something of a navy. They had sailed to this part of the world and taken it over. They did business all across the Mediterranean. They were wealthy. Excavations in Ashkelon. You can still visit Ashkelon. In fact, there was an article about Ashkelon not that long ago in National Geographic. Anybody see it? Interesting. It was an interesting article, and it revealed kind of how depraved Ashkelon was. It's been destroyed many times. But At any rate, these people were cool. And I mean that in the sense that you, if you'd have been an Israeli, living in the hills without a navy, without metallurgy, without a huge prospect of making your life prosperous, you'd have looked down to the Philistines and said to yourself, you know, I wouldn't mind being like a Philistine. I mean, the girls are cute. And they were. And that actually was one of the problems with Samson, was that he could not get his mind off the Philistine women. They were, and they dressed really cool, and they had the money, and they had fortified cities. They were a very upscale, successful, strong, pagan as all get out people. And here we have Israel living in the hills, all disjointed, not walking with God. That was their problem. God had said, you can have success if you'll walk with me, and they didn't. So they lived actually like a generation behind the Philistines with regard to technology, with regard to success, with regard to all the stuff that if you're thinking about the world, this is what you really want. They couldn't hardly get their act together, and they kept falling back into Baal worship, which they thought was the right thing to do because that's what all these other successful people did that were the Canaanites, you see. But when you belong to God, you think differently. You have to think differently. If you try to deal with life like a Canaanite, it'll never work. And you'll wonder, and then what'll happen is your life will just be a mess, and you'll say, why is my life such a mess if I'm a Christian? Or why is my life such a mess if I'm walking with God? A lot of times, not always, but a lot of times a person's life is a mess when they belong to God because they're not really walking with Him. They do belong to Him. They have a covenant, but they're not walking with Him. And they're essentially trying to walk both sides of the fence. They're kind of being a little bit of a Baal worshiper here and a little bit of a Yahweh worshiper here, and they're kind of living in the covenant when it's convenient and kind of not when it's not. And that is a surefire recipe for disaster. So, if you'd have been an Israeli who wasn't really walking with the Lord, what you would have really liked was to be just like the Philistines. Now, that's an odd thing, because normally when we read these stories, we think of the Israelis as the cool people and the Philistines as, like I said, the Klingons, the bad guys, who'd ever want to be a Philistine. In those days, you'd be surprised how much you might like to be a Philistine. And that needs to be understood, because that is very similar to the way culture is today in the world with regard to God's people and the culture around them. Sometimes it looks very, very inviting. But God still hated the Philistines. They were very pagan. They had three main gods, Ashtoreth, which we've already know about her. She's a fertility deity. They also worshipped a god called Beelzebub, Lord of the Flies. Lord of the Flies. That was one of their gods. And their most famous one was Dagon. Dagon, which means fishlet. That's what it means. And it's not something that you get at a restaurant where you get five or six of them and dip them in sauce. Fishlet meant little fish. Dagon. Dag means fish. The O-N ending meant little. It's a diminutive. Or fishy. Or fish boy. Kind of like that. Dagon was half man and half fish. It was a statue, usually pictured in a statue, with a man at the top and the fish at the bottom, or the other way around. There's an actual statue like this up in Paulsbo, Washington. I was walking along a street in Paulsbo, and I said, that's Dagon! It's a fish with it's a man's body with a fish's head. It's a little wooden thing. I don't think it really is. It was just sitting there. I thought, I gotta buy that and put it in my office. That is cool. I've never seen one. Dagon was their main god. He was actually not, it means fish, and he looked like a fish, but he was really the god of the fertility of the field, believe it or not. It wasn't about the fish. It was about the grain. They worshipped him because of the grain and because of the need for crops. So they're very pagan. They're also very brutal people. Their moral level was extremely low, sexually, in terms of respect for human life. Their way of dealing with the way of doing abortion, which was very common, was you waited until the baby was born and then you aborted it. It's only slightly worse than what we're doing. I mean, everybody's saying, oh, it's only slightly worse than what our culture does right now, all the time, by the millions. But that was what they did. In the articles on Ashkelon, they found even as late as the Roman period, thousands of infant skeletons in mass graves that obviously had been simply left out. That's what they would do. If you didn't want the baby, and usually it was girls, baby girls, that they didn't want, they just leave them out, let the wolves have them. No respect for human life. God, of course, forbade that entirely among his people. And radical difference. So you have this wealthy, pagan, successful, immoral culture, which has a tendency to seduce this rather sort of poverty-stricken, ragtag group of people who should have been walking with God but weren't and kind of were living in the hills. And they had their cities and towns, but they couldn't get their act together up there. That's kind of the way it is. And the Lord says, well, I'm going to let the Philistines thrash you for a little while. And that's exactly what happened. And that's the background. What happens is he says, well, no one's asking me. No one's even praying. No one's checking this out. So I'm going to do something on my own. And that's what you'll notice in chapter 13, which is how it opens. He comes to Samson's mom. We don't know her name. Mrs. Manoah. And he says, I'm going to do something whether you like it or not. That's basically it. There's no indicator that she's saying, oh, Lord, do something like Hannah, you know. Lord, give me a baby and I'll give him back to you. None of that stuff. In fact, both Manoah and his wife, the mother and father of Samson, are just kind of going through life. And the Lord appears to him, the angel of the Lord, and he sovereignly says this is the way it's going to be. And they're kind of amazed by it all, but they're not saying, hey, we're going to worship God. We're going to rededicate our lives to the Lord. There's really not even a whole lot of spiritual response on their part. More on hers than on his, but still, it's kind of like, it's a sad situation. Chapter 13, verse 1. Sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord, so that the Lord gave them into the hands of the Philistines for 40 years. That's a long time, a full generation. And there was a certain man of Zorah, of the family of the Danites. You remember in the map, if you had a map there that showed you where Dan was? And you'll notice that a couple of the towns we're talking about here were right on the border between Dan and Judah and so on. All right. His name was Manoah, and his wife was barren and bore no children. An emphatic statement. He repeats it to make it clear. It means they tried for kids and couldn't have any. Interesting, the number of women in God's economy for whom this was true. The first three matriarchs of Israel were all unable to have children until the Lord miraculously supplied them, Sarah, Rebecca, and Rachel, Hannah, Samuel's mother, and Elizabeth, John the Baptist's mother. They were all barren. And the Lord miraculously gave children to all of them, some more miracles than others, but still, it was an amazing thing. Well, Mrs. Manoah joins the ranks. The angel of the Lord appeared to the woman. Interesting, he didn't appear to the man. And I think when you read the story, you can kind of see why. I don't think the guy would have known what to do, which is a sad state, I think. The angel of the Lord appeared to the woman, said to her, now behold, you are barren and have no children. There are these times when the Lord just wants to get it out on the table and remind you of what you already know. You are barren and have no children. But you shall conceive and give birth to a son. Now therefore, you be careful not to drink wine or strong drink or eat anything unclean. Now some of you should be catching on here. If you don't even already know the story, even if you read it for the first time, if you follow the Old Testament, you should know what this is going to be. If she, even while she's pregnant, isn't supposed to drink any wine or strong drink or eat anything unclean, that means this child is dedicated to God while he's still in the womb, and it also indicates he's going to be a Nazirite, which is exactly the case. Behold, you will conceive and give birth to a son, and no razor shall come upon his head, for the boy shall be a Nazirite to God from the womb. And he shall begin to deliver Israel from the hands of the Philistines. A Nazirite, for those of you who don't remember, a Nazirite was a person, normally this was a voluntary thing, by the way. A Nazirite vow was normally a voluntary vow taken by an adult. They didn't cut their hair. They didn't drink anything from the vine. That's no grapes, no grape juice, and no wine. That's a huge sacrifice in that culture. That was pretty much the only thing that they drank besides water and goat's milk. And then no touching of anything dead. Now, that's very important to remember because Samson doesn't take any of this very seriously. He's born into it, and he doesn't take it seriously. Not supposed to touch anything dead. Now, the best reasons I've heard for why these things were true is because This person was completely dedicated to God. The fruit of the vine was the representation of joy on earth, earthly joy. And this person voluntarily had given it up. Normally a Nazarite vow was not lifetime. It was only a short period of time. This person voluntarily gave up that joy, no fruit of the vine. God is the God of the living. No touching dead animals during this vow. And you know, you don't cut your hair, because in other places in the Old Testament, when something belonged to God, you didn't do anything to it. You left it alone just like it was. Remember when they were going to make the altar for the Lord, the original altar? He says, you got to make it out of field stones, uncut field stones. Don't you put your hand on it. That was a reminder that if something really belongs to God, you don't mess with it. You don't carve it. You don't trim it. You don't cut it. You know, you leave it alone. If a vineyard was being left for the Lord, you didn't clip the vineyard at all. You just let it grow. And so the idea was that if a person belongs to God, they didn't do anything to their hair. They just let it do whatever. Some people just do that. It's not really a vow. I've seen them, and you think, you know, pal, you either need to take a vow or take a shower. But that's what's going to happen. And it's very important that this man is a Nazarite from his conception. God is miraculously intervening. This is the most amazing thing. There's not another judge of whom this is said. He's the judge with the highest potential of all of them, when you think about it. And he comes out really lowest on the stick. Also, I just want to point something else out for those of you who ever wonder. I know there's nobody in this room who wonders about whether unborn children are real humans. But if God can consecrate an unborn child in the womb and tell the mother not to drink the wine because the child is a Nazarite, that tells you something about how God views life in the womb, does it not? In other words, it's not like it doesn't matter what you drink, Mom, as long as after the baby's born it doesn't drink these things. No, the baby is a human on the inside. See? So, I know I'm preaching to the choir here. I know all of you guys already know that, but it's good to remember if you get in a discussion with somebody that's a very sound biblical concept. So, he says that's what's going to happen. And he will be a Nazarite, down through verse 7. Manoah entreated she came to her husband. Pooh, 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 pooh. She runs up to Manoah. She says, well, you're not, never, guess what happened? I talked to the angel of the Lord. Manoah said, well, I want to see him. Verse 8. Manoah entreated the Lord and said, Lord, please let the man of God who you have sent come to us again, that he may teach us what to do for the boy who's to be born. Now, he already said it. He told the wife, he told the mom what's going to happen. She came and told Manoah, this is what we're going to do. The baby's going to be born. He's going to be a Nazarite. What else do you need to know? I don't think Manoah really wanted to know any more details. I think Manoah wanted to see the angel. And he's a little dense even when it happens. But God listened to the voice of Manoah. The angel of God came again to the woman as she was sitting in the field. Again, he comes to the woman. And Manoah, her husband, wasn't with her. And the woman ran quickly, told her husband, behold, the man who came the other day has appeared to me. They didn't have wings and stuff, you know. They looked like men. Always, by the way, always angels look like men in the Bible. They always use male pronouns for them. And when they're described as ish, which is the Hebrew word for man. And so they always look like men. It's funny because a lot of times we'll make angels look like women in our culture. I mean, it's not that an angel could not take a female form. It's just that in the Bible, they're always men. So she says, the man, meaning the angel of the Lord. Come on, let's get. So Manoah arose and followed his wife, and he came and said, are you the man who spoke with the woman? And he said, I am. And Manoah said, well, now when your words come to pass, what shall the boy's mode of life and vocation be? But see, he already knew plenty of that. He's just making stuff up. And you know what? If you've read this, the angel doesn't answer him. The angel of the Lord said to Manoah, let the woman pay attention. And she'll tell you. That's the idea. I get the impression here's Manoah kind of muscling in there in front of his wife to talk to this angel. Wow, there's an angel here. And the angel looking right past him saying, let the woman know what's going on. In other words, I already told you. And she should have passed that along. She should not eat anything that comes from the vine, or drink wine or strong drink, nor eat anything unclean. Let her observe all that I've commanded. And Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, well, please let us detain you, that we may prepare a kid for you, a baby goat, a sacrifice. And the angel of the Lord said, though you detain me, I will not eat your food, but if you prepare a burnt offering, then offer it to the Lord. Manoah did not know that it was the angel of the Lord yet. He knew it was somebody important. He knew it was somebody amazing. He wasn't quite sure just exactly who yet. Although, I don't know. His wife had said, this is an amazing person. This is what he told me. I'd be sort of wondering by this point. But Manoah said to the angel, what's your name? So that when your words come to pass, we may honor you. It's a kind of a tricky way to get him to reveal himself, and the angel won't do it. Angel of the Lord said, why do you ask my name, seeing that it is incomprehensible? Wonderful. It says, he looks over his nose at him and says, you couldn't pronounce it if I told you. So Manoah took the kid with the grain offering, offered it on the rock to the Lord. And he performed wonders while Manoah and his wife looked on, because it came about when the flame went up from the altar toward heaven that the angel of the Lord ascended in the flame of the altar. And Manoah and his wife saw this, and they fell on their faces to the ground. Wow! So the angel of the Lord appeared no more to Manoah or to his wife, and Manoah knew that he was the angel of the Lord. So Manoah said to his wife, we're going to die. We've seen God. Which normally would be the case, but his wife has a much cooler attitude. I think that's why the angel was talking to the wife. I really do. Because she said, look, if the Lord was going to kill us, he wouldn't have accepted a burnt offering and a grain offering from our hand, nor would he have shown us all these things, nor would he be telling us stuff like this. How are we going to have a baby if we're going to die right now? That's a good bit of little bit of common, spiritual common sense. And Manoah's just freaked. He thinks we're going to die. Forgets completely that the whole purpose for God coming was to bless and to do something good. Oh no, it's the worst. We're going to die. I'm amazed. Some people, when they come to the Lord, they just assume life's going to be terrible now. Oh no, it's going to be terrible. I'm giving my life to God. But it'll be worth it because someday I'll get to go to heaven. Well, that's true. But you know, God says, I have come to touch your life. Do you think it's really not worth it to belong to God? It's amazing. We're going to die. No, we're not, the wife says. Oh, okay. The woman gave birth to the son, named him Samson. And the child grew up, and the Lord blessed him. And the Spirit of the Lord began to stir him in Manahedan, the camp of Dan, between Zorah and Eshtaol. And Samson went down to Timnah. Now, that's one of the towns you looked at on the map. It's down towards Philistine territory. And this, now he's a young man. He's probably in his 20s, or late teens, early 20s, marriageable age. And he goes down and he sees a Philistine girl. And he just thinks that she's totally cool. And he comes back to mom and dad and says, that's the one I want. And that's how he did it. The parents arranged things, but they would usually arrange it according to what the kids want. And if they could. So he goes down to Timnah, sees one of the daughters of the Philistines. He came back and told his father and mother, I saw a woman. I mean, maybe I'm too hard on this guy, but I get this feel. It's like, I have seen a woman. I want her. You know, it's like, hey, buddy, get a grip, okay? But that's the way he acts. I wouldn't say that if it wasn't for the rest of the story. It's kind of like his thoughts do not originate up here above in the, you know. It's, I saw a woman, one of the daughters of the Philistines, therefore get her for me as a wife. Then his father and his mother said, look, is there no woman among the daughters of your relatives or among all your people that you go to take a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines? But Samson said to his father, get her for me. She looks good. Actually, it's not just looks good. Literally, it is, she seems right to me. Literally, that's what it says. That's why it's rendered that way in the NIV. She seems right, or she looks like the right one. The Hebrew word that's used there isn't just that she looks good, it's that she seems right. Of course, here's a guy who's a Nazirite. Well, I'll give you three guesses if a Nazirite's supposed to marry a Canaanite. I mean, they can't even drink wine, for heaven's sake. So at this point in time, even though the Lord uses it, no question that God uses this, there's a big question whether or not Samson was taking anything seriously about his walk with God. The fact that he's dating down in Timnah and not paying any attention to the covenant. But still, the Lord has determined I'm going to use this man and I'm going to cause a war with the Philistines because I plan on judging the Philistines. So this is how he gets in there. And he uses this. Now watch how it happens. What happens is, I'll tell you what happens and we'll see what happens and I'll tell you what happened, okay? What'll happen is he's going to go down, they're going to set the thing up, it's all going to go south right at the main, at the wedding ceremony, at the big feast, everything's going to go haywire. He's going to go off and kill a bunch of Philistines, which is what God intended him to do anyway. He's going to come back, the Philistines are going to be ticked off, they're going to kill his wife, he's going to be even more ticked off, and he's going to start fires in all of their fields and burn down their crop. They're going to be even more ticked off, and they're going to come after him by the thousands, and he's going to kill a whole bunch of them and then run away and live in a cave. Okay? That's what's going to happen. But notice as we go through this, it's nothing about him saying, I got to fight the Philistines because God told me to. It's all about Samson, as far as Samson's concerned. So they go down with his father and his mother. And it says in verse 4 that this was of the Lord, for he was seeking an occasion against the Philistines. Now at the time, the Philistines were ruling over Israel. They were running everything, and the Israelis were not even, they weren't worshiping the Lord, and they weren't caring if the Philistines were over them, as long as they had peace. And Samson went down to Timnah with his father and his mother, and they came to the vineyards of Timnah, and behold, there was a young lion who came roaring toward him. Now, apparently, he'd been separated from his folks. Maybe they were at the house, and he went out for a walk, who knows, but he's by himself. And the Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily, and he tore this lion, he just killed it with his bare hands, and let it die. Just left it there. And he did not tell his father or his mother what he had done, verse 6. Now, this isn't bad. This isn't touching a corpse. I mean, if you kill an animal that's trying to kill you, that's not a violation. However, he doesn't stop there. He went down and talked to the woman, and she looked good to Samson. And when he returned later to take her, he turned aside to look at the carcass of the lion. And behold, there was a swarm of bees and some honey in the body, in the carcass of this lion. Out in the desert heat for some period of time, very dry, and you probably know what it would look like after being there, and pretty stiff and dry, and the bees found a place to, in a fairly short period of time, create some honey. And he saw it. Now, here's the test. He knows he's a Nazirite. He knows he's not supposed to touch a dead body. And he doesn't care. He reaches in and scrapes the honey, because you couldn't just go down and buy a candy bar. This was a major thing. I mean, you probably wouldn't be tempted by this. I, you know, if you drove along and saw some roadkill and saw a bunch of bees around it, you wouldn't get out and say, oh, let's see if there's any honey, probably. But you see, in those days, if you saw honey and you could get it, that was cool. Because you couldn't just go down to a store and get something to eat. Food was hard to come by of any sort, and it didn't keep, so there was fresh honey. So this is a major temptation. The question is whether he's going to keep his vow or fulfill his desire. That's the question. And when it comes to that with Samson, the desire wins every time. So he does it. He touches this carcass, takes the honey, eats some of it, takes it home, gives it to his parents without telling them what he did. Which indirectly, it really sort of implicated them in the situation. So he really doesn't care about these things. Also, he keeps some secrets from significant people in his life. By the way, if you're going to live away from God, you have to learn to keep significant secrets from people that love you and care about you. You have to be able to do that consistently if you're going to do things you know are wrong. And the more wrong things you do, the more you have to do that. So, verse 10. And his father went down to the woman. Samson made a feast there. So this is the official deal. They're going to the wedding feast. Several days they're going to eat and party. And that was the young men's custom. Verse 10. He came down, and they, when they saw him, they brought 30 companions to be with him. So it's quite a big party here. Now, Samson said to them, "Let me now propound a riddle to you. If you will indeed tell it to me then within 7 days of the feast and find it out, then I will give you 30 linen wraps and 30 changes of clothes." You might say, well, so what? That's a lot of money in those days. And Samson knew beyond a shadow of a doubt there's no way he could get his hands on 30 outfits, 30 complete wardrobes, so to speak. There's no way he could do that. But he's going to ask them a riddle that he knows for a fact they'll never figure out. And that's a sort of a game. And that's what they did. You know, they had a party, and he said, I'm gonna give you a riddle. You know. And, of course, he was in charge, so they had to kind of go along with it. But it's a riddle they can't get, and he's purposely goading them. He's not a man with a lot of discernment. He's sort of spoiling for a fight. He hates the Philistines. Why he's in love with this Philistine girl and how he got into this, it's, his life is kind of dysfunctional because he can't make up his mind. But here he is, and he makes this stupid riddle, and it makes these guys angry. The riddle goes, out of the eater came something to eat, out of the strong came something sweet. He's talking about the lion and the honey. And he thought, well, this is kind of cool. I'll give this, I'll lay this on these guys. They won't be able to get it, and I'll get a bunch of clothing out of it. That'll be fun, and I'll pull one over on the Philistines. Well, they didn't like that. So after he was, you know, they gave it 2 or 3 days, couldn't figure anything out. So they come to his fiance, actually, she'd be known as his wife now, even though they weren't living together yet. And they said in verse 15, "You get your husband to tell us the riddle, lest we," look at this, "lest we burn you and your father's house with fire." We will burn you alive. Because we are insulted. This guy came here, and this is an Israeli. He's insulted us. We are Philistines. You can't let him insult us at this wedding. It's bad enough that you're marrying him. You've got to find this thing out so we can win this riddle, or we'll kill you. These are not nice people. Don't get the impression that the Philistines, just because a pile of them get killed in the story, are innocent people. This is why God is after them. This is why he's judging them. They're going to burn this girl down and her house and her father and kill everybody in her family. So Samson's wife wept. Well, that'll do it. She wept before him. She said, "You hate me. You do not love me. You have propounded a riddle to the sons of my people and have not told it to me. You're not sharing your life with me. Behold, I have not told it." He says, "Behold, I have not told it to my father or my mother. Why should I tell you?" She wept before him 7 days. That is really hard to deal with. For 7 days, the feast lasted. It came about on the 7th day that he told her, because she pressed him so hard. So she told the riddle to the sons of her people. And the men of the city on the 7th day came as the sun was going down. This is just at the last minute. Samson's thinking, all right, 30 wardrobes coming my way. It's just the sun's going down. The guys get there just at the last minute. What is sweeter than honey? What is stronger than a lion? And Samson's face falls. He looks over at little Mrs. Samson-to-be, and he says, "If you had not plowed with my heifer," he looks at her, "you would not have found out my riddle." Now, you may wonder if it's as bad in that culture to call your wife a heifer as it would be in this culture. And the answer is yes. It is just as bad. He's ticked at her. He's ticked at them. And he calls her a heifer. He says, "You've cheated." Now, plowing with a heifer was indeed cheating. You never plow with a heifer in real life. You always use a bull. So he's saying, you know, "You cheated." And he puts it into this little rhyme. In a way, he's kind of got a wit about him, you know. At least he thinks he does. So he says, "If you hadn't plowed with my heifer, you wouldn't have found out my riddle." And the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him, and he went down to Ashkelon, and that's another city, right? So he takes off. They don't know where he went. And since nobody has cell phones, they don't know he goes down to Ashkelon and kills 30 guys. That's what he does, because he had to bring back 30 wardrobes, because that was the bet, and he lost. So he goes down, and he kills 30 guys. Now, see, you say, well, how could God sanction that? Well, wait a second. It's not about the bet. It's not about the wedding. It's not about anything except God saying, I hate Dagon. I'm killing Philistines because they are idolaters. So how Samson kills the Philistines, he does it because he's angry at them. But God's doing it because he had decided to judge the Philistines. And this is how it all starts. There's two things going on. Samson's got his agenda, but God also has his. So he goes down there, he kills 30 Philistines, brings back the clothes. And they gave, verse 20, they gave his wife to one of the other guys. Now here's the beginning of a major problem. Chapter 15. After a while, he comes back down to talk to his wife, and he brings a baby goat with him, you know, and he's going to go in and be with his wife. And the father stands in the doorway and says, "Noo-hoo-hoo, you can't do that. I thought you hated her. For heaven's sake, you called her a heifer. We gave her to somebody else." And Samson says, "Oh, really? Well, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll ruin your entire crop. I'll just destroy it." He goes out and he catches 300 foxes or jackals, little doggy animals, right? And he ties their tails together. This is a feat, this is a miracle just in and of itself. Catching 300 of these things, and then catch them two at a time, grab them by the tails, drag them, tie their tails together, take a torch, tie it to the tails, and he lets them run through the grain fields. Then he goes and gets another one, and another two, and he does this, and he does this 150 times. He sends 300 of these little critters out there, all through these, and the beautiful grain fields. They had all the beautiful area to grow stuff. Right during the harvest, starts these massive fires. There's nothing you could do about it. If he'd have just started one fire, they'd have come out there and put it out. But doing it this way, it ruined their whole crop. So he does this, and it is a miracle, truly, because you stop and think about how hard that would be. The indicator is that it actually wasn't hard for him. But again, the Lord was trying to hurt the Philistines. So here's Samson getting his vengeance, but God is saying, I'm actually teaching the Philistines something. So they come back. They say, who did this? And they tell him, Samson, the son-in-law of the Timnite, because he took his wife, gave her to his companion. The Philistines came, and they killed her, and they killed her father. They burned him, just like they threatened to. Because now they're ticked off because of their grain fields. So Samson now says, you did what? Since you act like this, verse 7, I will surely take revenge on you. But then after that, I'll quit. And he struck them ruthlessly with a great slaughter. Then he went down and lived in the cleft of the rock of Etam. We don't know. I mean, it just is one verse that could take a whole page to describe. We know later he kills 1,000 guys with the jawbone of a donkey. So whatever he did here must have been a pretty major thing. Now people are starting to realize if you go up against him, you will be killed. I don't care how many people come after him. I don't care what you try and do to him. He seems to be invincible. And that's exactly that is what's going on. So, but he takes off. He wants to go live by himself now in his anguish and his grief and in his, self-centeredness. He kills all these guys, does this sort of war, but he doesn't rally the troops. But he goes and then says, now I got to be alone. So he goes and lives there. Well, the Philistines went up. They said, we're going to make war. You're going to do this to us? We're going to get a war together. So they did. Verse 9. They went up and camped in Judah, spread out at Lehi. And the men of Judah said, why have you done this? They said, we want Samson. If you don't get him and give him to us, we'll kill all of you. And of course, they could do it. And the Israelis, instead of saying, Samson's a hero, we ought to walk with God, like with all the other judges, let's get our act together, have him lead us in battle, we'll beat the Philistines, instead of any of that, they go down to Samson, and they said, what is this you have done? We're gonna tie you up and give you to the Philistines. Don't you know that they rule over us? Look at verse 11. Don't you know the Philistines are rulers over us? What is this you've done to us? And he said, hey, as they did to me, so I've done to them. You know what's missing in this whole thing? Anybody saying, why don't we do what God wants? Samson, the person who's devoted to God, he doesn't stand up and say, hey, you guys, I know I got us into this, But the fact of the matter is, the Philistines are our enemies. They're not our friends. They've never have been our friends. They're pagans. This is our land. We should be actually making war on them. That's what one of the any of the other judges would have said, any of them. Samson doesn't say it. And the people are going to take the judge that God raised up and toss his head over the wall, so to speak, so they can have a weird equilibrium with paganism. They're actually going to kick out and kill, for all intents and purposes, they think, Samson. Just so that that's how dead this whole nation is spiritually. They are not thinking at all. That's what is so bad about the Samson, part of what's so bad about the Samson story. So they said, we got to bind you. We got to tie you up. Now they still, they don't understand that he'd be able to break these, apparently, these bonds. But he lets them do it. He says, just don't kill me. They said, no, we're not going to kill you. We're just going to give you the Philistines. Of course, what they do with you, we don't know. But here, okay. So he says, okay, go ahead and tie me up. And then they give him to the Philistines. And he waits until he's in with the Philistines and surrounded by the Philistines. He came to Lehi. The Philistines shouted as they met him. And the Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily so that the ropes that were on his arms were like flax, burned with fire, and his bonds dropped from his hands, and he found a fresh jawbone. It'd have to be fresh. For a guy who's not supposed to touch dead carcasses, he seems to find them. So here's this dead donkey skeleton, but it hasn't dried out. So the bone is large, and it's not going to break. It's not brittle. And he picks this thing up off the ground. Now, this is like a scene from a movie. There are 1,000 guys there. He picks this thing up, and he just goes after them, and he kills 1,000 guys with this thing. Boom, everybody that gets close. You watch martial arts movies where they work out these deals where the guys are doing all kinds of fancy stuff, and, you know, 15 guys come around this one skinny dude, you know, and this one skinny dude just jumps and screams and kicks and hits, and boom, all these guys are flying left and right. Well, that's kind of what happened here, except the skinny dude had a jawbone of an ass. So he hits them all, kills 1,000 guys. And then he said, he's great with poetry. He said that with the jawbone of a donkey, heaps upon heaps, with the jawbone of a donkey, I have killed 1,000 men. There's a play on the word between heap and donkey. It's the same Hebrew root word. And so it makes more sense, I guess, in Hebrew. But he's talking about, I made donkeys out of all of them and a heap of them in the process. So he's killing them, piling them up. And he calls it Jawbone Hill. And then he tossed, this is Jawbone Hill. And he makes this little poem and he throws this jawbone away. And then he gets really thirsty and he says, I got it. I'm thirsty, Lord. And the Lord miraculously gives him some water in verse 19. And apparently he was able, by God's grace, to remain for 20 years as a judge in Israel. And it covers the next 20 years pretty quickly. Now I want you to remember that, because this all happens early in his life. It sets the tone, but 20 years later, chapter 16, he went down to Gaza and saw a hooker and went in to her. And the Gazites, Gaza is a Philistine city. The Gazites recognized him. They said, Samson has come here. They surrounded the place. By the way, he never got married, apparently. Or if he did, he's fooling around. Whatever the case, he's back to his old tricks after 20 years, a career in the ministry. 20 years later, he's back to his old tricks. He's back down looking at Philistine women. And so they find out he's there, and they are laying for him. They're waiting for him. Except he somehow sneaks by him. Now, this is an amazing story. He waits until midnight, gets up, walks out, picks up the gates of the city. Now, those are about 15 feet across, an unbelievable feat. And he carries them close to 35 miles up to Hebron. Just hauls these gates, just picks them up, pulls them out of the ground, and walks off with them and leaves this city, Gaza, with no gate. And that was a major mess. They would not want to leave their city unguarded. So he takes off with the gate and leaves them in confusion. This little story, these first three verses, leaves more questions than anybody can answer. Why did he do this? What's the point of it? The only real point that we can see is it sets the stage for what we're going to read next. And he still has this strength. But you know, I wonder what kind of a guy he'd been during those 20 years. After that, right here at the end of his life, he's doing this. I'm wondering if ever at any time he really had the kind of character and integrity that he could have had. I don't know. Well, now he meets Delilah. And she's not doing a radio show. He loved a woman in the Valley of Sorek whose name was Delilah. Now, she's not a prostitute. This is a long-term affair, is what this is. He never married, but he had a long-term affair. There's another Philistine woman. And he apparently would go and visit her on a regular basis over a long period of time. And usually when you tell this story, it happens that you tell it, and it seems like it's happening every weekend, you know. She's asking him about how did I make you weak and so on. And that's probably not how it happened. Probably happened over a period of months, maybe even a year or two. And so bear that in mind as you read the story. But he has this long-term affair. The people in the area figure it out. The Philistine leaders come to Delilah. They offer 5,500 pieces of silver, which is in that economy is an immense fortune. I mean, an absolutely immense fortune. Each of the kings of the five cities of the Philistines kicked in 1,100 pieces. To make it 5,500 pieces. And this is an immense fortune, and she buys it. She says, okay. And so she, you know what happens. She says, oh, you gotta tell me the secret of your strength, or I just don't think that you love me, you know, if you don't tell me. Well, he thinks he's never gonna tell her. He thinks he's never gonna tell her. That's why he toys with her. And for three times in a row, he first says, you know, bind me with cords. And you know the story, bind me with cords. And so she gets her buddies to hide in the next room. And then she surprises him, the Philistines. And pop, he pops those cords. Then the second one is new ropes. Okay, try this. And she does it again. And pop, he pops the new ropes. Ho, 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 ho. He takes off, goes back home, comes back, you know, a few weeks later. And this keeps happening over a long period of time. And he's toying with her. But he doesn't realize that by toying with her, he's actually toying with himself, his own fate, his own destiny. He's sure he's never going to tell. And he knows all he has to do is keep the secret. Besides which, he doesn't really care that much about the vow. We've already seen that. He's not sure exactly. Because he's never cut his hair to find out. So he's been told this by his mother, and he never checked it out, but he's always been strong. And it's like this untested theory, but it's back there. And since he doesn't have a strong enough walk with God to keep the vow just because it's the right thing to do, it's very dangerous for him to be teasing her this way. And of course, you know what happens. She does the loom thing. You know, he teases her, tells her, put it in a loom, put all my hair in a loom. So he falls asleep. She does this. He pops the loom out. Finally, she wears him down. And in verses 15 and following, she says, you've lied to me three times. She's starting to get pretty serious with him. You know, you're threatening me. If you want to keep coming and visiting me here, you better fess up. You know, what's doing it? He says, okay, all right. I've never cut my hair. You know, we always wondered about that, all of us Philistines. You've got the longest hair in the whole world. We always wondered why that was. I never cut my hair. If you cut my hair, all my strength will leave. So she realized somehow, intuitively, that he had really told her the truth this time. And you know what happens. She traps him. He stands up, thinks, oh, I'll just go and do this again. And as he stands up, he says, my head feels lighter. I feel a breeze on my neck. I wonder why. And he turns around to hit somebody, and there's no strength. And they completely, it says the Lord had departed from him and he didn't even know it. You know, there's a lot of people who believe that Samson is a picture of Israel in the Old Testament. Miraculously conceived, formed specially by God to do something that would show the covenant to win, but never took the vow seriously, ended up flirting with the enemy all the time, and finally ended up losing everything. And yet in the end, God was still faithful. You trace that through Israeli history of the Old Testament. And through the Babylonian captivity and all the flirting Israel did. It's an interesting thought. The Lord had departed from him, and he didn't know it. They seized him. They gouged out his eyes. I mean, I just cannot imagine. These are brutal, horrible people. They immediately hold him down and gouge his eyes out. They bring him down to Gaza. They bind him with chains. He became a grinder in the prison, pulling the stones around so they could grind, and they made fun of him. And however long it took for his hair to grow back sufficiently, he was in there for a few months. And then you know what happened, 23 to 27. This is about Dagon again. The lords of the Philistines assembled to offer a great sacrifice to Dagon, their god, to rejoice. They said, "Our God has given Samson, our enemy, into our hands." See, they thought it was Dagon that had done all this, and it was really the Lord God who was judging his own man, and it made the enemy think he was winning. When the people saw him, they praised their God. They praised Dagon. Can you imagine that? "Well, praise you, Dagon." Well, that would be absolutely gross. I can't imagine. A fish. We're worshiping a fish guy. "Our God has given our enemy into our hands, even the destroyer of our country who has slain us." You know, they knew how powerful Samson had been. And it so happened that as they were high in spirits, they said, "Call for Samson. Get him out here. Let's make fun of him," you know. And so they did. And you know what happened? He came out on the pillars. Interesting that in Crete, which is where the Philistines were originally from, the pillars that they use in Crete are larger at the top than they are at the bottom, archaeologically. They've dug them up. They've looked at how they built their palaces in the ancient civilizations on Crete. And one of the interesting things about the way that, apparently, the way that they did it was that they were built in such a way, engineered in such a way, that they got bigger at the top and narrower at the bottom, whereas usually you'd make it the other way around, or at least straight up and down, which under certain circumstances would make them somewhat brittle. If these Philistines built their places like they did on Crete, which is where their ancient forefathers were from, it would be an interesting thing to see how a person could stand on two sides of the main beams, push on the bases, and pull the place down. And that's what he does. Finally, Samson has come to an end of himself. Samson said to the boy who was holding his hand, they're all railing on him, he's standing there. He said, "Let me feel the pillars on which the house rests, that I may lean against them." The house was full of men and women, and all the lords of the Philistines were there. About 3,000 men and women were on the roof, looking on while Samson was amusing them. And this is actually his high point. Samson called to the Lord, he said, "Lord God," first mention, the end of his life. I mean, better late than never, but finally he calls out to the Lord God. "Please remember me. Please strengthen me just this time, O God, that I may at once be avenged of the Philistines for my two eyes." Is it repentance? I don't know. "Let me be avenged for my two eyes." But it was God's plan to use Samson to kill Philistines. That was what he was to do. He could have done it in a lot better way. But at this point, the Lord said, yes. He grasped the two middle pillars on which the house rested, braced himself against them, one in his right hand, the other in his left, and Samson said, "Let me die with the Philistines," which is something I think a little bit apropos, as sad as that is. He lived a lot like a Philistine, and he said, "Let me die this way." He bent with all his might so that the house fell on the lords and all the people who were in it, and the dead whom he killed in his death were more than those he killed in his life. Then his brothers and his father's household came and took him, brought him up, and buried him between Zorah and Eshtaol in the tomb of Manoah his father. He had judged Israel for 20 years. Well, we've seen kind of what's wrong with Samson, and yet you can also see the grace of God in it, the grace for the nation anyway, that he had insisted on doing what, you know, God insisted on doing what was right. Just a couple of conclusions and a couple of thoughts. He was born for God, but he never lived for him. Now that is such a sad thing. And as a pastor, I see people born again and who don't live for the Lord. And may I encourage you, once you belong to God, he takes it very seriously. There really is only one good way to live. And that's 100% for the Lord's glory. Samson had all the potential, and he blew it worse than any other of the judges, because he had more potential than any of the rest of them. He was born for God's purposes, but he never lived for the Lord. You compare that with Samuel, and we'll see Samuel pretty soon, and also born of a barren woman. And yet Samuel, from the time he was young, walked with God consistently. And Samuel was no wuss either, I tell you. He could whack a guy's head off just as fast as anybody else, and he did when he had to. He could be a warrior. But he was a man with a heart for God, and here's Samson, who had all that potential. Never did a thing. I mean, he was supposed to, here's the second thing, he was supposed to deliver Israel. This is very important, but he only fought for himself. Now, he ended up delivering Israel in a strange way, but every battle Samson got in was about Samson. It was never about Israel. It was never about God. It was always about him. His life, everything about him, it all revolved around him. And his vow, yeah, that was great. And he was glad to be strong, and he did kill a bunch of Philistines, and you know, he did trust God about that, but it would have been so much better if he'd have done what the Lord wanted him to do. He did everything just for himself. God was still glorified in the long run, but Samson always simply fought for himself. So let me offer just three thoughts. Number one, it's never too late to really goof your life up. All right? That's the thing you should always remember about Samson. 20 years, he's at least 40. That's an old guy in those days. He's got a career behind him. I mean, his previous messes back when he was younger, those are over. He's served the Lord for 20 years. Then he goes down and finds a hooker. Hello? And then he gets involved with Delilah and the whole thing. And you know what happens. It's never too late to really goof your life up. So always remember, no matter how long you've been walking with God, you're only one or two bad decisions away from ruining everything. Because virtue does not save up like money. It doesn't. Virtue is lost the minute you make a bad moral decision. Even after a lifetime of walking with God, you walk away from him and you make a bad moral decision and the reputation's gone just like that. You can't save it up and say, well, I want to have my reputation back. I mean, I did really good for 20 years. It just doesn't work that way in real life. So no matter how old you are, no matter how long you've been walking with the Lord, don't let your guard down when it comes to the things that tempt you, because it's never too late to really goof your life up. Secondly, we're never too strong to really get tripped. You can be super strong in the Lord, and you can still be tripped by something fairly small. If it is something that is a besetting sin, you need to stay away from it at all costs. You're never too strong to get tripped up by a weakness, no matter how strong you are. And that was, of course, his weakness was Philistine women. And of course, that temptation isn't gone at all. We're never too strong to be tripped up. And here's the third observation. You're never too gifted to fail morally. And no matter how gifted a person is, when they fail morally, they fail. We live in a world that says, oh, well, we got to have so-and-so because they're just so gifted. And I agree. Gifted people are mightily used by God. But Samson is the classic example of a man with no character, all kinds of gift, and really wowed the crowds, but no character. You're never too gifted to fail morally. Character really matters. Samson, when you read the story, and in fact the entire book of Judges, Samson's story is not that he's a hero, even though when the Lord puts his name among the faithful in Hebrews 11, it's a reminder that God still took Samson to be with him, even though Samson failed consistently. But you don't want to fail consistently. You don't want to live that way. You do want to be gifted, but you know, if you had a choice, think about it now, seriously. If someone walked up to you and said, I will give you all the gifts that you want, you pick it. You pick it. You know, I want to be the American, you know, skinny and rich and tan. That's what I want to be. Or strong. Skinny and rich and strong and tan and good looking. I'll give you all of that It's just that you will have a little moral problem all the time. You won't have any real character. Is that going to bother you? Or is that going to tempt you? On the other hand, another person comes up to you and says, I will give you the strongest character that God can supply. But you're going to be ugly. What can I tell you? And you got to choose between one of these two. Now, seriously, you know, we laugh, you know, we just read this story. But, you know, that's a lot what our culture, that's kind of what's going on in our world. Except we don't have a choice of whether we're ugly or not. Or whether we're good looking, right? How would you choose, and what kind of moral decisions do we really make? Young people make the bad ones. Older people should make better ones. We need to be able to grow into understanding this as Christians and really walk with Him. Let's bow our heads. Father, thank you for teaching us from the Judges. Even though we're not done, we finished the last judge anyway. And we see, Father, that you indeed are the hero at all times. You are indeed the faithful one. You've used us in spite of ourselves so many times. And in your grace, you continue to hold up the new covenant in our lives. Lord, we ask that you would teach us how to live wisely in the covenant, how to know what you want, how to live with character and depth and maturity. Lord, you know how tempted we are. You know how close we are to making mistakes, how often. So please strengthen us all. Please teach us through Samson's life, not how to be strong, but by contrast, how to be wise. As we leave this place and go to work and do the things that you've called us to do, live in our families and our marriages and face the temptations of daily life, please give us wisdom from this, that we might, by the time we're done, be able to say, we've lived with you. Thank you, Father. We love you. In Jesus' name. And all God's people said, amen. Amen.